Hey there, everybody. I wanted to let you know that coming to Pendleton, Oregon on Saturday, June 29th, it's Jackalope Jamboree, featuring American Aquarium, Shane Smith and the Saints, Lily Hyatt, Carson McCone, Pete Krebs, and Jamie Wyatt, plus Tyler and the Train Robbers, Bart Budwig, James Dean Kendall and the Eastern Oregon Playboys, the Lonesome Billies, and more! Taking place across two stages at Pendleton's historic Happy Canyon Arena, located in Northeast Oregon. It's going to be a full day of live music paired with local food, craft beer, and wine. Camping and RV spaces are available too. Tickets on sale now at jackalopejamboree.com, and our listeners can get 15% off their ticket order by entering promo code WALKINGTHEFLOOR. That's jackalopejamboree.com, promo code WALKINGTHEFLOOR.
Hey, it's Will Hogue, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor. It's a very fine edition today of Walking the Floor. It's a beautiful day here in sunny Southern California. I'm just sitting here looking out at the sun, and there's a little breeze, and my cat's just like sitting in the window, and life is good. I can't complain. As a matter of fact, I'm going out tonight, which is pretty weird for me when I'm at home. I don't get out much, let me tell you. But I'm going out to go see Hayes Carl tonight at the Troubadour, and I'm really, really excited because I'm gonna interview him tomorrow at noon. I can't tell you how long I've been waiting to interview Hayes Carl. When I first started this podcast, I actually went to his website. He was one of the first people I ever wanted to interview because I'm just a huge, huge, huge Hayes Carl fan. So I went to his website and there was like a contact, you know, link on there, and I sent an email that I never got a response to, saying like, I'm starting a podcast and I'd love to interview you, or what, you know, that type of thing. And it took a few years, and as a matter of fact, I was supposed to interview him when we were down, we were both down at Luck Reunion at South by Southwest a couple of months back, and it didn't work out. Things were just a little too hectic, but oh man, I'm excited. Gonna see him play tonight. I've never seen him play live. And then I'm going to go interview him tomorrow. And if you haven't heard his new record, whew, you are missing out, because that is really, really, really good stuff. That new Hayes Carl record. I think I might even actually, tomorrow I might be interviewing the Cactus Blossoms. That's not locked down yet, but I think I might be interviewing them tomorrow too. So look for both of those interviews coming soon on Walking the Floor. All right, now, friends and neighbors, I don't know if you know, but I got a new record coming out, new solo record coming out called Hard Lessons, coming out in the middle of June, June 14th. But you can pre-order it now on iTunes, you know, the store over there at iTunes, and on what else? Amazon Prime, I think you can pre-order the record, and you can also go to my website, Chris Shiflett Music. .com, and you can order it there, pre-order it there, and get a bundle, get a bandana, get a signed, the first 100 of them, I think, are coming signed. I signed like 100 record sleeves the other day, and the first 100 people that order them will get a signed vinyl copy of the record coming right to you soon. It's like less than a month and a half, June 14th, so please get on over there now and get your pre-order together. What are you waiting for? All right. Now, let's not forget that support for Walking the Floor comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback Program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback Program, get yourself on over to playback.d'addario.com. D'Addario, come on. And if you want to get some D'Addario strings, get your butt on over to Zounds.com. That's Zounds with two Z's, where you get free shipping on every single order. No exceptions. No exclusions. Most orders arrive within 2 days. So if you need your cool music gear stuff, a guitar, a pedal, amplifier, some pro audio gear, whatever it happens to be, get on over to zounds.com. All right, let's get to the interview. You know, I'd never met Will Hogue prior to interviewing him a few months ago. But you get a sense, I think, from certain artists through their music about, like, you know, kind of who they are and what they're going to be like. And this man did not disappoint. I'm a huge fan of his music. He writes, like, great anthems, and he's just a fantastic, fantastic songwriter. And I don't know, I just had a sense that he was going to be cool and an easy hang and good to talk to. And he was all those things. For those of you that are a little squeamish when we talk politics on this show, I suggest you skip the first part, because we definitely go there. He's got an album that's been out for a few months called My American Dream that has a bit of a political bent to it, and we dive way deep into that. But we dive into all kinds of other stuff too, you know, music, songwriting, growing up, blah, blah, blah. All that good stuff. He was great. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. This is Will Hogue on Walking the Floor. And I work two jobs to raise a family. So your new record, like, just came out this month.
A week ago? 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks
nice.
Ago,
I think. Are you in the middle of, like, you know, crazy promo and touring and doing all that? Doing the big wind-up?
Yeah, we just did, we just finished the Social Distortion tour, so that
really?
Was, yeah.
How was that?
Fantastic.
Wait, were you out there with them when Mike got in that fight?
We missed that by a week. We were out there once they started hauling security around. Right. That's where we were.
Right.
Well, we were worried, you know, because when we put this new record out, we were like, you know, I don't know, you know, their political persuasion. Like, what if we get out in front of them and they're conservatives or
right.
you know, crazy right wingers? And then this, literally the next day, we had this conversation and we got forwarded an article and it was like, Mike Ness punches Trump fan at show. Yeah. And we were like, oh, we'll be fine on this tour.
It's okay, funny, it'll be fine. Man. Like, I've been a huge Social D fan since yeah. forever. You know, I mean, they're a big influence on me, you know,
likewise.
Musically and otherwise. But I interviewed Mike a few years ago. I never really knew him, you know, like yeah. I had been in various bands that had toured with them and, mm-hmm. but never really had like a lengthy conversation. And I was, you know, Mike's kind of an intimidating
yeah.
dude.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I sat down to interview him and I was blown away at how sort of progressive he was. He started talking about animal rights and shit. Like, I was like, yeah. what? I thought you were from Orange County, bro.
I know. And he's, you know,
what are you like, talking about?
We laughed. He must have eaten his weight in Impossible Burgers this whole tour. I mean, you know, we were just, it was really, it was cool, man. And the whole band, I mean, you know, that band is really
right, yeah.
good.
Yeah.
And the catalog of songs is great.
I love how they do the old stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, I love how they do Prison Bound with, mm-hmm. I don't know, because we toured them a few years ago and they had, like, you know, the Hammond on it.
Yeah.
Seeing the stuff to kind of roots it out a yep. little bit, you know?
And they still do, which was cool. And then, you know, they would do stuff, you know, in the middle of the tour, they all of a sudden added different songs and were playing them at different, you know, different tempos. And you
right.
could just tell that it was guys that have played together a long time.
Yeah. And, was there any like backlash for on their tour from that whole thing? Like, were there like,
so.
You know, protesting nah. angry Trump people?
No,
out
no,
there,
no. There really stuff? Weren't. I mean, I think that, I mean, and that's the thing I think that we realized on it. I mean, you know, they've been a band for so long. And I think that he's written and addressed some of those progressive ideals over the years. So I think that they've probably weeded out the majority of people.
It's an interesting thing, though, in the world of punk rock. And,
yeah.
And granted, you know, they've been at it for a long time. It's not like there's some punker dunker band or whatever.
Right.
But I've always been kind of blown away at how deep a sort of libertarian strain there is in that world.
Yeah.
You know, less progressive, more like, you know, don't tread on me.
Yeah.
Fuck the federal government or whatever. You know, that
right.
whole kind of strain. I guess that, you know, it sort of lends itself to that. But it's, I've never, my personal experience is that it's not a very progressive community oftentimes, especially on the fan base side of it.
Yeah. And I don't know enough. I mean, you know, I grew up loving their records and I love punk rock, I guess, sort of at a distance.
Right.
And some of that was, there wasn't a ton of great punk rock coming out of Nashville, Tennessee,
right.
you know, when I was growing up. So, you know, I loved it in sort of old friends, older brothers record collections way. So, but I didn't go to those shows, didn't, you know, they weren't playing Nashville very often.
Right.
So I didn't see any of those shows.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, even seeing it now, I can see where that might not be the most progressive place. But
funny you say that, because even like, you know, in the 90s, before I was in Foo Fighters, I was in a band called No Use for a Name.
Yeah.
And we toured a lot. You know, we did tour coast to coast all the time. I don't think we ever played Nashville.
Right.
You know, we would play Atlanta. We'd get down into Florida because Florida had a surf scene, and the surf scene liked punk rock. You know, so there were places, you know, it's not like we didn't tour the South or anything.
Yeah.
But we never played Nashville.
Yeah. I mean, we just didn't.
I don't even think we played Memphis. Like, we didn't play anywhere around there. Mm-mm.
You know, we laugh about that. Alan, my drummer, is from just Nowhereville, Mississippi. I mean, tiny, tiny Mississippi. And he grew up really loving all of that stuff. And, you know, I mean, we've laughed all the time. He's like, you know, I'd have to drive to New Orleans or somewhere else.
Maryland or something. Yeah,
right. To drive to Ohio to see a punk rock show.
I mean, so you mentioned your new record has like a political bent to it. You know, it's sort of tagged a political record. Like, is that a tag that you're comfortable with?
I don't love it, but I also can't. I mean, I can't write those songs and then go, oh, no, it's not political at all.
Right. I mean, you deal with, like, you know, for people listening that maybe haven't heard the record, there's like, you know, gun control, Trump, illegal immigration, Southern stereotypes. It's like, it's all in there.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's a very political record. And like I said, I'd be doing the record injustice and probably leading people astray if I tried to act like it wasn't.
Right.
You know, but we're also not. The thing I've wanted to make sure didn't happen, you know, our shows aren't going to be political rallies. And that's really important to me, because I don't want that. You know, I want our shows to be a rock and roll show where people come and have a good time. But you can also think and be challenged with those things too. But
yeah,
you know, that was the bigger problem for me, was just trying to avoid that.
Is there any pushback from your fan base on
that?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, you know, you don't grow up in the South and make roots records, and you know, and I had some success in the real, quote unquote, real country world,
like mainstream country,
country world as a writer, and you know, and a lot of those artists have been really kind to me, and the genre was pretty open to what I was doing for a little bit there. So I mean, I don't dislike any of that, but that's not exactly, talk about punk rock not being progressive. That's punk rock is Antifa compared to, you know, mainstream country.
Well, it's funny, you know, how does the sort of the business side of Americana deal with an outspoken artist? Because I, you know, I don't find people in business in general, regardless, you know, Americana is sort of branded as a more progressive sort
it's country
of
country music for liberals.
Yeah. Right, exactly. You know what I mean? But like, I don't find that to be all that true. And like, how does the business side of, you know, business people tend to think in terms of business friendly?
Yeah,
safe, well, I mean, ideas,
there's no
you know?
Yeah, and there's no, I mean, even this record, I mean, it's a terrible business idea. There's nothing good. Nobody is going like, you know what we really want to try to market? It's something that is guaranteed to piss off a fairly large amount of people. I mean, nobody wants that. But, I mean, you know that. Art isn't always good business.
Well, we're living through this crazy time, you know,
that,
and especially these last couple of years, like it's, in my view, it's, you know, it's a rejection of neoliberal economic policy, or just neoliberal policy in general. And, you know, you have these like two different strains of that. There's like the left-wing version of populism and a right-wing version of populism.
Right.
The Democratic Party has just done a better job of squashing their populist uprising, you know, which is, I think it's an interesting thing to deal with, because a lot of the issues that you raise on your record, to me, aren't going to be solved by electing another corporate-owned Democrat.
I don't think it's going to be solved by one election or one individual.
Right.
And I hope that I'm glad to hear, I hope the songs, I mean, really and truly at the end of the day, I don't know that they're not these pro-Democrat and all Republican.
Right.
I mean, Nikki's a Republican now, is fairly pointed at, Republican.
Yeah.
But
is that an autobiographical song? Like, did you know, is Nikki a,
I went to school and grew up with a lot of Nikki's. Yeah. there were a handful, more than a handful of Nikki's in my experience.
But you know what I mean? Like what I'm getting at, like I think it's, and I say this from a, like, probably a more left-wing view than the vast majority of the world out there. I'm not a Republican. I don't really care about Republicans. I'm not one. My criticism is more reserved for my side of the aisle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's really tempting in the age of Trump and I see a lot of people around me. I mean, I live here in California. Mm-hmm. It's like the, you know, the professional class, you know, base of the Democratic Party. I don't see people really going through a gut check these last couple of years, you know?
Yeah.
And it scares me because I want to see Trumpism defeated or made irrelevant. And I feel like most people just want to defeat Trump. And those two things are not, that's not the same thing.
No, I mean, he's the name that they've stuck on it. But, you know, his totalitarian and authoritarian ideals, that's not new. I mean, you know, and that's where I think we haven't done a great job as progressives of really pointing that. Like, I don't give a shit about defeating Republicans. You know, I long for the days when the Republican Party was just conservative and they wanted things to change slower than I wanted them to change. And we could disagree about economically how we do things and all of those deals. But, you know, the mainstream of what Trump has become the figurehead for is way bigger than that. It's not a difference in economic policy or anything like that anymore.
Right. You know? I think it is, though. You have to go through Ronald Reagan and George Bush and Clinton and Obama and W and all. You have to go through all those people and their policies, which are, you know, there are some major differences. But on terms of economic policy, it's not that different.
Well, I mean,
the Democrats have really embraced, you know, the more or less the same economic policies as the Republicans over the years. And you sort of see that deindustrialization of America and globalization and what that has produced. And now, right now, is people standing up going, yeah, fuck that. That doesn't work for me. I got to work three jobs. I can't support my family. The public school my kids go to is crumbling. So you sort of have to address that stuff.
We do. And you know? I don't think as Americans we don't like hard answers.
Right.
We want these
like sound bites.
We want the bumper sticker. Yeah. We want the pill. Like, I don't want to be fat anymore. What do I do? Nobody wants to hear like, you got to change your diet and exercise every day. And you got to do it every day for the rest of your life. It's not something like, you don't just eat this pill and you're like, I look like a cover girl model now. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
And we
it does work like that in LA.
Does it? It's really expensive.
It's not a pill, though. It's a
vacuum cleaner and a scalpel. Yeah. I mean, that's a scary thing for us. I think that we've got to, and it's interesting, I think, you know, we're getting of the age where there's not, this used to be our parents would fix it. You know, there was always somebody older than us that would go, well, you know, they know what it is
the
and
experts.
They'll figure it out.
They're going to come in and fix it.
And you start looking around and it's like all of a sudden we're the one, you know, our kids are looking at us and going,
that's such a scary thought.
It's terrifying.
You're a dad, right?
Yeah,
I'm a dad too. Like, I don't feel like an expert.
I know. Well, and then you start to realize that none of those people were like all the people we looked at.
Well, that's what you realize too when you grow up and like, I mean, I've had the, you know, I've been around a lot of like, of the political class over the years from, you know, whatever, from playing, being in Washington and playing fundraisers and things like that.
Yep.
And you kind of have that moment where you go, oh my God, these motherfuckers are stupid.
Yeah, they're as dumb as we are.
Totally.
Like, they're a bunch of fucking drummers. It's totally fine. Yeah.
We can't say that on the show.
Oh, sorry. Wait, fucking or drummers?
Which one do you mean?
Oh,
drummers.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we can't make fun of drummers.
The real bad word. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned growing up in Nashville. For people listening that have never been to Nashville, and I only have been to Nashville much in the last, like, say, 20 years or so. But you grew up there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how has that place changed? It's such a boom town now. And when I go there and spend a little time there, I hear people that have lived there for a long time sort of complaining about the development and all this stuff. How has it changed over the course of your life?
Probably in ways that you would hear people talk about L.A. in the 50s and 60s, I would think. You know, there's just a point where you don't get a lot of those true boom moments like you mentioned. I mean, and it really is funny to watch. I mean, you know, and the people that complain about it, I mean, there's things that obviously we could do better. Infrastructure and transportation, you know, it's just, I mean, there's 100 people a day
moving to Nashville.
Right. And
did it feel more like a small town, big city, small town kind of vibe when you were a kid?
For a long time. And, like, and honestly, not a big city, small town. It just felt like a small town.
Right.
With a little bit of concrete, you know, in a 4-block radius downtown.
But you always had the music business there. Like, did you grow up? I imagine, I think about it sort of in context of my kids. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in LA. I'm raising my kids in LA.
Yeah.
They go to school with like the children of famous actors yeah. and people in the entertainment business and musicians and all that sort of stuff. Like, mm-hmm. was it like, were you going to school with like Ernest Tubbs kids? And shit
yeah.
like that?
Well, and it was fun. Yeah, you were. And that was the thing to me that was the most encouraging thing about wanting to be a musician and growing up in Nashville is you saw the normalcy of it.
Right.
You know, so like you were in school with not even the big superstars. I mean, there were those kids, but there were also like the guy that was just the front of house dude.
Right.
For Merle Haggard,
yeah,
you know,
would
his kids would go to school there.
Right.
And the guy that was
Sideman or whatever.
Yeah, the bass player in some, you know, country band that hadn't had a hit in 20 years, but they were working and they were musicians. And so it was cool. And it's still an interesting thing. You know, one of the really cool things about being from there and now with my kids is, I mean, you know how hard it is being away and you know how hard it is for your kids to, you know, miss you and things like that. But, you know, they're also in a class where, I mean, my kindergartner, when he was in kindergarten, you know, there was Taylor Swift's drummer was had a kid in his class and Dierks Bentley's bass player. And so
right,
it's like, you know,
right.
when the kid comes to school and he's sad that his dad's on tour, there's
they
four other kids
it.
That are like, come here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah.
We're all sad because dads are gone.
Yeah.
And it's cool for, you know, the wives have a support group.
And, right.
Yeah. So
right.
It's a really unique city in that way. It's been fun to watch it.
I had a funny, like I said, we just wrapped up a tour cycle, and so I've been gone a lot, you know,
yeah.
in the last year and a half, and you can always tell, like, at the end of a cycle, when it's starting to strain,
uh-huh.
you know, when your kids are kind of like,
yeah.
it used to be they'd get sad, now they're sort of indifferent, which I think makes it worse for me.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
They
but
don't
like,
even miss you anymore.
Yeah,
you're like,
hey, you know,
wait.
Well, exactly, like, I was like, you know, I was coming home last week, and I called my wife. She's like, well, you know, the kids all have like sleepovers the night you get home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, fuck, no way. Are you
uh-huh.
kidding? I want to see my guys. And she's like, well, I know I said that. And Dashiell was like, you know, Dad, just he's here. He's gone. I, you know, he comes and goes all the time. Why does it matter?
Yeah. Why do I have to change my schedule for
exactly,
him?
Yeah.
I know.
And I get that point of view, but I was like,
I know.
Boy.
You're like, no, you need to want me to be
exactly,
here.
Exactly.
You
yeah.
should drop everything.
Yeah.
No, they don't.
No.
Totally over it.
No, they don't. So your dad was a musician. Is that right?
Yeah. He grew up, he and my uncle were in that wave of, you know, the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Mm.
And then everybody bought guitars and
right.
started bands. And so in Nashville, my uncle was a little bit older and he had a band that played in Printer's Alley back when that was, you know, this really almost speakeasy kind of night hangout. And
yeah.
they were doing kind of like Four Seasons, really harmony oriented stuff. And then
wow.
my old man's band was doing kind of the Beatles-y thing. And they, yeah, they did a fair bit of that all the way through kind of birth of children and then got out and got real jobs.
Oh, so by the time you were like
by the time up. I was a kid, by the time yeah he was done, I mean they would still occasionally do like a reunion show
right.
for their
did he still play
buddies.
Around the house? So like I'm curious if that made you want to play music or was like made you go like I ain't gonna do that. That's my
no
dad's thing.
He didn't play around the house, but the thing he did have, like the record collection was stellar.
Right.
I mean, you know, when people ask that, you know, and you get it all the time too, it's like, you know, what'd you listen to growing up? And it was like, man, I had every great record from 1964 to 1975.
Right, right.
Alphabetized and still in shrink wrap, you know,
perfectly
really?
Done. Your
yeah.
dad was that kind
he's,
of record
he's
collector.
Still, it's still
see,
there.
Get away from the record collection.
Totally. Like, didn't touch it. Like, they're slit with a razor blade.
Right,
it's what I'll retire on when he's gone. Yeah.
Nice.
I'm just killing my music time until
right.
he kicks the bucket and I can
yeah.
sell his record collection. No. Yeah, so he didn't grow up playing, but he grew up. I grew up. There was this huge love of music.
Right.
And the way it was talked about, it was really revered, I think,
right.
is the best
right.
way that I could put it. You know, music was important. And like he you know, he would tell these great stories. It was always really romantic to me, you know, because they had toured with the Allman Joys, you know, Greg and Dwayne
really?
Allman before the Allman Brothers.
Right.
And
yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, he would tell these stories about and, you know, those guys were like really heroes to
sure.
me, especially as a really young musician. And so you'd hear these stories and they were really kind of larger than live.
Yeah.
So those things were always super romantic. Yeah.
And so when did you start playing? Like, was guitar your first?
Yeah, I didn't get a guitar until I was a senior in high school.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, you're giving me so much hope for my own children because because this has been like the bane of my existence for right. since I had kids. It's sort of having that balance of like, I really want them to play, but I don't want to ruin it.
Yeah, you don't want to be the showbiz dad either.
Exactly, and I don't right. want to be like forcing on it. I want them to want to uh-huh. do it. Yeah, my kids, like all kids these days, they don't really listen to a lot of music that has guitars.
There's not a lot of it anymore, is there?
No, and you know they listen to a lot of hip-hop, which is all well and good, but like I really want them to want to play guitar. Last night, I actually went upstairs, and my kids were... I bought my youngest son a bass, and they were sitting there learning Seven Nation Army off of YouTube.
Yes.
Which I was like, fucking finally.
Go.
And it didn't happen.
And you back out of the room.
Totally. Exactly. Like, I was like, I didn't even want to react. I didn't want to go, like, this is the best thing. Let me get involved. I just tried to, like,
pretend I'm not even here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you have that similar experience with your own children. But anyway, so you didn't get a guitar yourself until the 12th grade. That's fascinating. Yeah.
And I had grown up, you know, singing was sort of that was easy. And that was kind of the first thing just growing up, you know, we had little garage bands in the neighborhood and stuff like that. And
you'd sing.
Yeah. And then once I got a guitar and started writing pretty quickly after that, and then it was just all downhill. I mean, I tried college for about half a year.
And why do you think you started writing? Because a lot of people don't pick up a guitar and start writing. They just, you know, learn some songs or whatever and go that route.
And I mean, as a guitar, you know, you may be different. I never wanted to be a great guitar player. Right. I want to always be a better guitar player.
Yeah.
But I was always fascinated by, you know, I remember as an early teen, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan kind of hit. And that was the thing. Everybody was like, I want to play guitar. I want to be Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Right.
And I loved Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I wanted... The blues was so interesting to me, but not as a... I never wanted to be this guitar... I never saw that as a guitar player thing. I saw it as a singer-songwriter
right,
thing.
Right, right.
So I think that some of the writing for me was... I wasn't good enough to play other people's songs.
Right.
Really and truly.
Yeah,
And so it became... you know, I know the G, the C, and the D chord... I can make up a story around that.
Right. So
that was kind of the gateway drug, I guess.
And so what was your pathway to sort of becoming a, you know, however you want to call it, professional musician or what? Like, if you didn't start playing until 12th grade, how quickly was that moment for you where you sort of realized you were a lifer, where that was where you wanted
pretty
to go?
Quickly. I mean, my first year of college, I joined a band. There were some dudes, I mean, I literally like, and you sound so ancient when you say shit like this, but like in the dorm, there was a piece of paper with like looking for a singer with the shit that you pull off at the bottom with the phone number on.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, I called these guys and joined a band. And shortly after that, by what should have been my second year of college, I mean, we were playing pretty regularly just around, you know, Nashville and Kentucky. I was in school in Kentucky in Bowling Green. And so we were sort of playing around there, and by 6 months later, I had quit school and was doing this and chasing it pretty hard. And then moved back home and started other bands. And then within...
What'd your parents say?
You know, that's an interesting thing. Mine were really supportive until I quit school.
Right.
There was that moment where it was like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah.
You know, this was a cute hobby. And they'd be at the shows and real supportive. And then... once you kind of bail and it becomes, you know, high wire walking without a net, they're like, wait. And it took probably a good year and a half, 2 years of working. And then once I started making a record, I think then they realized like, oh, okay, he's serious about it. It's not.
And your first record, did you put it out yourself or it came out on an indie or something? Then it got picked up by a major?
Yeah, the first record was really a live record. We had recorded a board mix at the Exit Inn in Nashville years ago. And we had just started touring kind of regionally. And
would that have been a normal thing to do? I think back to when I was in, you know, my early bands. We never thought about touring. There was no regional tour circuit to go on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just never entered our minds. But I thought that was interesting that you started touring before you were making records.
That was the first thing. And that was an interesting thing about the Southeast in particular. I mean, my first record, I guess it was 99. And there was such an interesting thing. You know, live music seemed to still be a bit more of a thing at that point. And especially in the Southeast, you know, you had these bands like Hootie and the Blowfish that were just this college band, but they would tour around. You know, there was still this like college scene that you could go and play and people would come out, and there were record labels that paid attention to it and things like that. And then you still had, you know, there were still holdovers from, you know, the REM days in Athens, and you had guys like the Drive-By Truckers and these bands that really did, you know, in the Southeast, there was a pretty healthy just touring circuit.
Right.
Kind of like you hear about the old Chitlin' circuit.
It was kind of the
plastic cup circuit, I guess, for lack of a better term. But yeah, so we started doing that, and that's when my folks finally kind of eased up and said, well, fuck it, we've lost him to the muse.
So how did it go from doing it yourself to getting a label involved?
Like, so we did that.
How'd you get signed or what?
I signed, you know, another thing in Nashville, you know, there's a publishing structure and songwriting deals and things like that. And there was a guy that I had been in, he was the guitar player in my dad's band for years, and he was a music publisher, and he signed me to an artist deal like you would in New York or one of those things with a publisher. And out of that, I was able to fund my first record. And so we did a Right and Proper studio album. We did part of it in Nashville and part of it in Memphis. And then put that out on our own, and for a year just went and toured. And then Atlantic picked up that record. And then we kind of just went from there.
With, you mentioned having a publishing deal as a writer. So were you like in those like three guys in a room sessions, you know, Monday through Friday kind of thing?
I wasn't at that point. This one was much more like probably just the traditional artist publishing deal. Like go write your songs and make your record. I think they probably would have loved me to have done that. I was terrible.
Did you eventually do that? Have you had like,
years
have you
later
done it?
After... I had written a song called Even If It Breaks Your Heart, which was a country hit for some guys in the Eli Young band. And that one led to a real traditional Nashville publishing deal. And I did a full 2 or 3 years of that, sitting in a room trying to make up songs for people that you don't know. And
how does that work? I've always wondered the sort of the business side of those deals. Yeah. So do you get an advance or a salary or something like that? And then what happens if one of your songs is a hit? Like, does what you, if you have, say, a third of that song or whatever, how does everything that they've given you thus far, is it like any other kind of record deal, publishing deal, everything gets recouped and then eventually you wind up getting a royalty on
it?
And so what's the equation? Like, how many songs, how many hit songs or cuts do you have to get to be sort of like, you know, making a good living?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, it depends on how big a lump of cash you take up front.
Right.
But those guys have got it. That's the most sterile, like there are operating rooms that are less sterile than some of those things. I mean, you know, those deals just come in and it's, you know, they go and just to the penny go, okay, you're worth this amount of money. We're willing to bet, you know, 30 grand a year that if you write 12 songs, we'll make some money.
Right.
You know, but then I think a lot of young writers get lost in the idea though, if you owe a company 12 songs a year. I mean, shit, man, you and I probably write 12 songs a year in our sleep. But if you write with three people, then you owe them 36 songs a year.
Oh,
you
Really? Yeah. Okay.
And so, you know, then all of a sudden...
isn't it kind of assumed that you're going to write with three? Isn't that like just sort of the norm?
Yeah, but in those meetings, you know, you don't... there's some doe-eyed little kid in there that's 20 years old that's just going, wait, you're going to pay me... And of course, they'll... low, you know, we'll give you $20,000 a year, and all you got to do is write 12 songs. It's like, cool. Like, we're going to write with these three people, and then you're like, 36 songs. Yeah, I mean, that's it's an interesting world. And there's guys and girls, I learned a lot doing it. And there's guys and girls that are really, really good at it.
Yeah.
I mean, the kind that can just sit right here, you know, finish this interview and go, okay, let's write a song.
Yeah.
And hum something, and in 2 or 3 hours, there's a mildly palatable, completely non-offensive song with a nice melody and a story that won't offend anybody. And
it's interesting. Wild. Like, you know, I haven't done a lot of that. I've never been like, I've never lived in Nashville and I've never worked in that songwriting culture, but I have written with some guys out there here and there in the last few years.
Yeah.
And some really good writers and stuff. And it is a funny thing though. Like anything, because I tend to write, it's not like all my stuff is political, but there are political themes throughout it, or it could be, you know, understood that way.
Right.
And I find people have a real aversion to anything that gets a little, you know, oh, that's a little dicey. What else you got?
Yeah. You know, kind of, and you can just see it the minute, like, you start with something, like, what else you got is my favorite thing. It's like, don't say you don't. That, see, even in that, they won't just go like, no, I don't want to write that. It's like, what else you got?
Yeah.
How can I not offend you by saying that I don't want to do that? And we laugh, you know, because they're, I mean, I've had some really good co-writes. I'm sure you have too. I mean, I've written songs that I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
That I'll play the rest of my life that have been co-written with people. I love the process. But there's also a moment where when you get too many people and there are too many of those opinions where you start to really get into the land of if everyone is just okay with this. Like nobody loves it anymore, but it's just like, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
You know,
not fucking amazing.
No. And even if you've got like one of the people that's fucking amazing and two other people that are like, I don't know. Like, I'd rather hear that song, I think, than the one where three people are going, it's totally fine. That rhymes. Right. You know, like, oh, good. It rhymes. Yeah. Thanks. We're professionals. Yeah. It rhymed.
Funny. Yeah. So, okay, so then you wind up getting signed to, who was it, Atlantic?
Atlantic.
So you're in major label land.
Yeah.
How did you find that experience? I'm especially curious because you put out records in like a lot of different ways, through indies
and
yourself, through major labels. So I'm curious, like, which sort of version of all that you enjoyed the most or was,
well,
you
know, just,
was worked best for you?
Man, they've all worked really similar as far as the seat that I'm in, because I think I'm probably hard-headed enough in most of the right ways that, I mean, I don't get, it's not like when I made major label records, they were going, okay, you have to do this. You know, they would, there were obviously more opinions for who producers were and how you kind of needed to do things.
And your songs are like anthemic, a lot of them. It seems like it would lend itself to, you know,
Well, the major label world was interesting because I do think at the end of the day, they want hit songs.
Sure.
They don't care if it's hip hop or it really doesn't matter. And I don't mean that as a complaint. They just want something that they can sell at the radio.
Yeah.
And I do, I mean, I grew up, I still think of radio. When I think about songs, when I think about a chorus that's something you want to sing, I mean, I still think of, I imagine that coming on a radio in my car when I'm driving, even if people don't listen to music that way anymore.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that the major label world was an interesting journey for me because that's the path to get to that place. But it's a lot of politics.
Right.
And, you know, you also realize really quickly that you're the little fish in this really, really massive pond. You know, I remember I'd never been on an airplane and we signed our deal. We finished a sold out show and I flew my first flight out here to LA to sign, you know, this paperwork and do all this. And, you know, we came and we were at CAA at the time. And I remember going in the lobby of that office and going, holy shit. Like the fact that we sold 600 tickets in Greenville, South Carolina last night does not mean shit to these people. Like, it's not, you know, you just start going like, oh man, I've got to really perform on a massive level
to keep these people's attention,
to really matter to these guys.
Right.
And, you know, at the time I had two offers on the table. One was Atlantic Records with Ahmet Erdogan. I mean, which is like this dream come true for a rock and roll kid from Nashville. And then the other option was this new indie label from Nashville called Lost Highway. And they had two artists. One was this lady, Lucinda Williams, that nobody had heard of. And the other one was this guy, Ryan Adams.
Right.
You know, and at the time, you know, I didn't have great management helping me with it. But, you know, you just go, what are my options?
And, yeah.
You know, the big shiny ball in New York seems like a really cool, that's what the rock and roll dreams are made of.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember at the time, the Lost Highway guys, they sent an envelope to my manager, and it said, there were two envelopes inside the envelope, and one said Lost Highway, and one said Atlantic. And when you dump the Lost Highway envelope open, it had a little piece of paper that said Lucinda Williams, one that said Ryan Adams, and one that said Will Hoag. And then the other one was every artist on Atlantic and their names. And they said, you know, which one is easier to find your artist in? And that probably should have been a more powerful realization for me at the time.
It's easy to look back now and go like, you know, why didn't we know that? But like, you know, in that moment,
yeah,
you can't possibly know.
No.
The shiny ball is fucking,
yeah,
it's inviting.
It is. You know? And again, like, you know, I go back and I look at, you know, you sit in the office with Ahmet Erdogan and he tells you stories about Ray Charles and Otis Redding
and Mick Jagger
and yeah, like, and he tells you like about your record and he, you know, what songs he likes and what he thinks,
what he hears in it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it was sincere, and you know, and so shit. I mean, as a rock and roll fan, and then you look at your Led Zeppelin records and you see the Atlantic logo on it, you go, fuck, I want that on my record. You know,
yeah.
So yeah, it's just, that's what I've learned through most of this, is just that there's not a lot of right or wrong choices. There's just, this is the decision, and then you take the good and the bad with it.
Right. And the same thing, the reality too, is the same thing could happen at either label.
Totally. Well, there's going to be problems at either. And,
right.
You know, and so, yeah, you know, did that for a couple of years and then left Atlantic. I made what was really my first sort of political record in 2004. I did a thing called the America EP. And we had done okay at Atlantic, and they were real supportive. And we came to them with this project, and they said, look, we love this, and we support what you're saying. But, you know, if these are the kinds of records you want to make, I don't know that we should be involved. And so I said, okay, then I should go somewhere else. We parted, and I'm still friends with all those people. The Atlantic folks have been supportive when we've been on the road with their artists over the years. But so I left and started doing it on my own again.
It's a funny thing that, like, the business side of this world are very like, if you had written, they'll call you an outspoken artist or whatever, you know, whatever little thing, if it's like left wing views.
Yeah.
But if it's like jingoistic, like America's fucking great, this one's for the troops.
Kick all the brown people in the ass.
This doesn't align with our, you know.
They're like, we should get Lee Greenwood to cut this song.
You know what I mean?
No, there's none of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then left and did a couple records on my own, and then did a couple records with an indie label in New York called Ryko Disc. And then back on my own, and then started working with the 30 Tigers crew in Nashville. And
is that who you put your records out through now?
It is. And that's what we've done the last three or four records with. And
I mean, how have your expectations of releasing an album changed over the years? It's such a weird thing nowadays to, like, when, at least for me, when I put out a solo record, I just go, well, nobody's going to fucking buy this thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Hopefully we can get some streams.
Well, and that's what's funny is, you know, we were laughing. We got the first, and I try really hard not to pay too much attention to that. And I damn sure don't want to be Mr. First Week guy. You know, like, it sounds like you're doing movies in LA at that point. I was like, what was the opening week like?
But, yeah.
You know, you do, you look, and you at least want to know, you know, who bought the record, where, and, you know, get what we were laughing was the sound scan report, you know, but they send us now what's called a consumption report, and it's
it was
I felt like I was in college again, because it was like I was looking at this thing and going, I don't know what the fuck any of this means. So I mean the expectations are limited, I guess, is the best way to put it. I mean, really, it comes down to, and I find it kind of encouraging, is the row. I mean, who's willing to really go out and try to put on a great show every single night and slug it out? And if you are, and you're great at it, there's ways now that are easier than ever for people to get your music and hopefully come and buy a t-shirt and, You know, we've sold more vinyl. That's the other thing that's hilarious. I mean, if you'd asked me 10 years ago if we'd be selling vinyl records more than we're selling CDs, I'd have said that you're crazy as shit. But it's that way every night.
Right.
You know, even on a live show. I mean.
And so do you maintain like how many shows a year do you think you get out and do?
You know, for years it was in the 200 range.
Jeez.
Which
that's
is
a lot
insane.
Of shows. Yeah.
And then, you know, I got, when I met my wife, that slowed down a little. When we had kids, that slowed down, you know, a more appreciable amount. And we're a little more human about it now. But it's probably at least 50 or 60 shows a year kind of regularly. And then album release times, it's probably closer to 80 or 100 worldwide probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is still great. A lot. You know?
Yeah, it's a ton. Yeah, it's a ton. And I assume that's your immediate future is filled with lots of...
Yeah, we finished this week.
The road.
Yeah, we go home for a little bit, and then we've got one more week. Then we're off for the rest of the calendar year, and then Europe. I'm over there with Lucero in December.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I love those guys. Yeah, and then nice. The band and I will be back the first part of the year, and then tour next year.
Man, I've been wanting to interview that Ben Nichols dude for a long time.
You should do that.
Never lined up.
Oh, yeah.
Drop, put that in his ear when you're over
there.
I will
certainly do. He's great. Man, that whole band is cool. We saw a couple of those guys. The Social D Run was in Memphis last week. And
a
bunch of those guys were out.
I think my buddy Matt Ross Spang worked on their latest record.
Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken.
He did. Do you know Matt?
I do. He engineered a record I made a couple of years ago.
Oh, great.
He was the funniest dude in the room, like in his quiet, totally twisted sort of way.
He's a gifted guy, man. He's really, in that chair, there's not a whole lot of people better than he is.
He's amazing. Yeah. I actually met, he reminded me when we were working together that I had met him years before that when he was, I don't even know if he was an engineer yet. He just worked in the gift shop at Sun.
Really?
And I went in there when we were in Memphis, you know,
that's
on like
crazy.
A day off or whatever. And he was like the dude selling t-shirts
really?
Or whatever. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, he's earned his stripes.
Yeah. I was happy that he reminded me that I had put him on the guest list for our gig. So
that's
I think
good.
He twiddled those knobs.
Made him extra sweet.
Good uh-huh. when we worked together.
Good for you.
Do you would you like to play a song?
Yeah, man.
I would love that.
Great. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah, this one is called Mr. Barnum. It is loosely based on Circus Life and probably... will be easy to see through who the song's really about when you listen to it. So, you told us all that this would be the biggest show that we had ever seen. You said it would be huge, the greatest of all time. That everybody here could have everything that they had ever dreamed. But now the crowd is getting restless, thinking that you lied. The ringmaster is gone. It's just a clown down here alone. Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus back home. It seems your big top ten ain't as large as they said that it would be. And all the things you said that we'd see inside are gone. No strong man, no dancing bears, nobody swinging on trapeze. It's just one bearded lady down here to tell us nothing's wrong. And the ringmaster is gone. Just a clown down here alone. Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus back home? He
beat your pride leading to a fall, and you just laugh like it don't matter at all. Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus back home? The ringmaster is gone. It's just a clown down here all alone. Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus back home? We wanted to believe you, but now we just want you to get out of town. Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus? Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus? Oh, Mr. Barnum, won't you please take your circus back home?
Yeah, fantastic.
Well, thank you.
I was imagining when you were playing that, that's what it must be like to like be a fly on the wall when you're writing a song or something, like in your garage, strumming it out.
It's pretty much the way it is, yeah.
All right, cool. Awesome, man. Well, thank you.
Man, thanks for taking the time to do this. This is really cool. Thank you.
All right, that was Will Hogue on Walking the Floor, doing an awesome acoustic rendition of Oh, Mr. Barnum from his latest record, My American Dream. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com, and I'm going to put up a bunch of links so you can find out where he is, what he's doing, buy his t-shirts, buy his CDs, and stream his music. Okay, and don't forget, when you get done with that, get on over to my other website, chrisshiflettmusic.com, and pre-order my new record, Hard Lessons, coming out on June 14th. First 100 copies of the vinyl bundle get signed. That's right, signed copies. Get on it, quick. Just less than a month and a half left to go. That's it for this week. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Adios, amigos.